Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Dr. Walter Dean, and this is Getting It Done. I am your host, of course, and last week we started with a series on the great Duke Ellington. And this week we will continue with part two on Duke Ellington. Before we get started, I want to throw out a continued happy birthday to a young lady by the name of Marty, who I met and had a chance to sing for last night, and who happens to be a great singer herself. And she is soon going to be going back to Puerto Rico, and if I don't see her again, I hope she has a very safe trip. And so without any further ado, let's go on and proceed with the great Duke Ellington.
Next, part two of a Duke named Ellington, an American master.
Oh, but that had such a strong influence by the music of the people. The people, that's the better word. The people rather than my people. Because the people are my people.
American Masters is made possible by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Arts. With additional funding from this station and other public television stations, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Marilyn M. Simpson Charitable Trust, and Rosalind P. Walter. Additional funding for this program was provided by the Sandra Atlas Bass and Edith and Saul G. Atlas Fund, Incorporated.
I'm telling you the tune that
I think he played more than any other, because I think we played this every night for the 28 years I was with him, which was New Indigo. I think we played that every night for 28 years. Yeah, and I just loved it.
People have asked me, why wouldn't you get tired of playing? No, I never got tired, because every time I played, it was like the first time. I would find out, you know, maybe I held this note a little long. Maybe I cut this one off a little. And tomorrow night, I would twist it around this way or that way or what have you. It was mine to play with. Oh, because when Duke sent you out to the mic to play, you were on your own. You did your thing when you walked out to the mic, which is wonderful. And I knew Raymond would freshen it up like you pour water on a flower to keep it blooming. And they'd all bloom fresh, fresh arrangements.
Well, a little new treatment on a big old favorite of ours.
That you ever heard of. He said, all right, you make B flat, you make so-and-so, you make so-and-so, you make so-and-so, you know, everyone in the band. He said, all right, let me hear that sound. Let me bring his hand down. Bam, he didn't do that a damn bit of the ever in life.
Ha, Characteristic of Ellington, Reagan, and arranging in the 1940s and 50s. The jazz during that period was undergoing a major transition. Bebop was a new influence, reflecting the tempo, the lifestyle, and the restlessness of the generation. Smaller musical ensembles, combos as they were called, were rising in popularity. The breakup of many well-established orchestras gave support to the idea that the days of the big band were numbered. But Ellington had an uncanny ability to select virtuoso musicians and create a unique style that embraced the traditional sound as well as the modern. This proved to be a combination which endured and captivated new audiences. Perhaps the best evidence of that was Newport.
The Newport Jazz Festival in 1956 turned out to be a real time for the orchestra, mainly because as a sheer chance incident, when Duke decided to play crescendo and diminuendo and blue, or the diminuendo and crescendo, had it back to front. Paul Gonzalez started taking a solo, and Duke kept encouraging him to go on and on and on. He wound up playing 27 choruses on this fast blues, and the audience just went crazy, and it was the hit of the festival.
Very well, but you know one of the secrets of that thing that many people missed the point. They only heard Paul Gonzalez playing, but they didn't realize what egged the thing on was us giving them a good rhythm behind with our feet and our hands, which really built the thing. But you never knew that. All you knew was Paul the whole time. And It's just one of those moments when you strike something and you drive, you know. And we didn't know this was going to happen, but it happened. It's just the right time.
And before you know it, Duke was on the cover of Time magazine. It represented a sort of renaissance of the orchestra. And ever after that, Duke would say, "I was born at the Newport Jazz Festival on such and such a date in 1956.
Duke didn't get in the discipline as far as telling a man what he should do and what he shouldn't do, unless it was Paul. Paul Gonzalez, he would play almost take him by the hand because that was Mercer's buddy. And Duke would straighten him out every now and then. But Paul was wonderful. He would get drunk and do things. And once I remember we were in the Far East and Paul fell off the stage drunk. And he got up and he was playing Ramona. I mean, the band was playing something else, but Paul was playing Ramona. And during intermission, Duke says, "You're through, you're fired. Just, I don't need you around here with that." And he hit Paul on top of the head, and Paul says, "Wow, Duke, you play rough." And Duke had to laugh himself. So Paul continued right on the trip. So he was wonderful.
No assigned duties. I mean, he has no quota to write.
or anything like that. We have something to do, and I say, we've got to do this. And it just happens, you know. I mean, even maybe if I've stopped, I may be somewhere like in Los Angeles, he's in New York, and I get to the 17th bar of a number, and I decide, well, I think rather than sit here and struggle with this, I'll call Strange. And I'll call him and say, look, I'm in E-flat or someplace, and the mood is this, and, you know, this man is supposed to be walking up the road, and he reaches a certain intersection, and I can't decide whether he should turn left, right, go straight ahead, or make a U-turn. And he says, oh, yes, I know what you mean, you know. And, well, I think you could do that better than I could. That's his first response, you know. And all the time, he's thinking about how he can outdo me, you know. And very often, without any more than that, we come up with practically the same thing.
Thank you.
had the good fortune, of course, of having the same musicians to work with over a period of many years, and so we have wound up with a system of very highly personalized writing. So practically every note that's written is written for some specific instrumentalist in mind to take the solo responsibilities.
You probably often heard it said that the band was his instrument. Well, he had you could play the band for the way he wanted to hear the sound, you know. And he knew how the sound he had in his mind when he wrote it, and he picked certain musicians to carry out what he had in his mind. For instance, there was one note that Rex Stewart used to play with what he refers to as a cock valve or a half valve, which is that's an E natural. And every time Rex would play that note, it would get a sort of a half effect of the note itself and a slur, a semitone. So Ellington, every time he would write this, on the scores, he would find that in this chord is the D concert note, the E natural for the trumpet. He would, wherever the part was, he would switch that note to Rex's playing. So he had this unique idea of the sound that he wanted. He also, on many occasions, would put Harry Carney, who's the lowest horn in the saxophone, he would put him on the top, you know. And he had this is a compilation of many different types of sound that he had concocted in his brain that nobody else had thought of before. Of course, since then, a million guys have copied in the post.
You call me 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and say, I'd like you to write something on this or do that. And I would do it, and it worked out pretty good, you know. There's many little things that I did in that band that you might hear in with another music setting. Maybe something Strayhorn did, or my section, or like this Perdido here we have now. I just added that chorus in the deep Perdido. Clark Terry added one, and it was a combination of things done. The co-op thing, you know?
He was a great compiler of ideas, and this thing that Barney McGuard used to play, he made a tune on that, Who Indigo. And the Barney used to kind of warm up a little bit, and Cody did do-da-da-da-da-da-da, Cody warmed up on that. And he took these things and made tunes out of them. A lot of guys have the wrong idea. They say, well, he stole from these guys. But these guys, that's as far as they would have ever gotten. We would have been a tune. He didn't know where to go from there. And the same thing with Barney, I understand. So he was a compiler of needs and ideas and just a marvelous person with a great facility to make something out of what would possibly have been nothing, you know.
Well, all these people are an inspiration in themselves to write for. Mm-hmm. And every musician in the world has some limitation. There is no musician in the world who has no limitations. I mean, you take the world's greatest virtuoso symphony violinist.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of things he can't play.
Right.
And he is as high and as good a musician as you can be.
Sure.
You know. And by the same token, you take the guys who are considered jazz musicians, there are things that they can't do.
Mm-hmm.
But the wise players are those who play what they can master.
Mm-hmm.
And this is true in every caliber of musician.
Absolutely.
And I had the good fortune of having these people who have individuality of job to write for. And it presents problems sometimes. You take somebody like Tricky Sam. He had, when he worked with a plunger, there was a certain position of his mute inside of the plunger. You know, the plunger's on the outside and the mute's inside there.
Yeah.
And there's certain positions when that plunger, to get a certain sound, there were only 7 notes,
mm-hmm,
that were very effective. And so you have to write and only employ those 7 notes, you know?
7.
And this presents a little problem. Then you combine them with somebody else's limitations, and naturally you become an inventor after a fashion. I mean, because you create total devices sometimes that you stumble up on them accidentally.
He wrote, you know, for the bass trombone. He'd have a little limited to play. And
I tried to fashion some of my own writing after that same idea because it's much richer than anything else that I've heard.
Future generations that Duke Ellington was a great composer for orchestra, and specifically, of course, for his own orchestra. That was what he did best, was write for musicians, and he had a particular artist in mind. And he had Cootie Williams in the trumpet section. He wrote a number that was designed to suit the personality of Cootie Williams, the same with Johnny Hodges on alto saxophone, the same with Lawrence Brown on trombone, the same with all of them.
It can come at the piano, it can come away from the piano, it can come while you ride around the country. So it comes when you have isolation, mental isolation. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to be alone. It can happen when you're with other people, when you're in a crowd, because you have that mental isolation, something stimulates and things that.
Sometimes we'd ride down the highway at night, and we were going from one place to another, and maybe the band was going to stay overnight in one place, or either they'd ride the bus, and Duke and I would be traveling, and he'd say, "Lights," and I'd turn the overhead light on, and he'd sit there and mumble a little and write on gum wrappers and cigarette papers and all that, and match boxes, and then when we'd get where we were going, he would say, "Herbie, put this together." And just holding all these wrappers and things. And that night he would tell, in one of these small towns, he'd say, "I've written this wonderful tune for you." And that was the rehearsal night. he rehearsed this for these people and then go on where we were going to a big concert. He'd be ready when we got there. And he'd rehearse that in all these little small towns. But he had written this special thing for that.
He'd get one show at 9 o'clock in the evening, and with a bevy, after that show, there would be a bevy of ladies over 60 in his suite, you know, caring for him. And, you know, he called his parents, his 50 to 60-year-old ladies, after which he'd go down and play another show about 1 o'clock in the morning, socialize after the show, and at 4 in the morning, he'd call me up and say, Alvin, are you ready to work? Are you ready to work on the river? So I would go down, and he would be in his robe with his piano, his portable piano in front of his bed, at his music sheets, and from 4 o'clock in the morning until 7 o'clock in the morning, we would work on the river. And then after I'd had it, I'd leave about 7 in the morning, go to bed. I would hear his piano tinkling until 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning. Robert Duke wrote the music, and which we had a very close collaboration. It was a ballet that was commissioned by American Ballet Theater in the early 70s, and I actually spent time with him on the road while we were trying to conceive this ballet. He had by then collected all the great modern music of the world, I mean Handel's modern music and La Belle's La Mer. He had researched accurately all the modern music, all the modern themes, and all of that to prepare for this ballet. Thought his music was dance music. He told me that any tune that he played was supposed to make people move. And searching through the Ellington canon of music, I found this piece called Night Creature, a piece which was especially interesting because it's written for a symphony orchestra and the Ellington band. And the recording we use has Duke Ellington on piano and all of his wonderful soloists like Johnny Hodges and Paul Gonzalez, together with the Paris Opera Ballet Orchestra and the Swedish Symphony Orchestra. Yeah. It's a very interesting text of music. There's a sensuous second movement, which is based around a piano solo of Ellington's. Together with his genius attitude. I mean, the elements of ragtime and blues and swing and proper early folk songs, I mean, Creole Red Call, and, you know, Eastern sophistication, and it's just a huge talent. I mean, it connects us with our past, the Wellington music, you know. It's some of those Wellington tunes are black folks' national anthems, you know.
We never talked about race. He would believe more or less that people were people, because his friends went from any color or any craft or anything, but he never believed in colors. He never went, in, as far as I know, he never went in for coloring. He just said people are people, and some of his best friends are Chinese, Japanese, white, black, everything. And that's why I think that the black, brown, and beige covers everyone.
And now we'd like to play portions of Black, Brown, and Beige. Black, Brown, and Beige was a rather long piece we introduced in 1943 in New York at Carnegie Hall.
For Ellington, the introduction of Black, Brown, and Beige marked the beginning of a new phase of creating and performing extended works. Referred to Black, Brown, and Beige as a time parallel to the history of the American Negro. When asked about his attitude regarding the struggle of black Americans, Ellington stated that he involved himself through his music. He preferred the implied statement, the unconscious flow of social comment naturally reflected in his works. Such compositions as Black and Tan Fantasy, Deep South Suite, Afro-Eurasian Eclipse, and the Harlem Suite gave evidence of his recognition of his Afro-American origins.
Yes, I think he did make statements in his music, and I think the statements were more or less for people to realize their situation in life. And I think most of Duke's music was hopping music. You know, you could, you always had a beat to his music. So I think that's the way he expressed himself as far as our people. We have a beat, and that's the way our music is. Just music, not jazz.
Jazz? We don't use the word jazz. As a matter of fact, we haven't used it since 1943. We believe that everything is so highly personalized that you just can't find a category big enough. And jazz certainly isn't big enough. A category to combine so many wonderful people. You go back and you take all the great people who have been listed in the history of jazz, like Bache and Armstrong and all of them, Django, Dizzy Gillespie, Hawk, all great people, Ben Webster. Everybody's got his own individual style. In a country in the Far East where you have billions of people, a very, very tiny percentage of them have even heard of the word jazz, you know, or know anything about it. And so we can't depend upon it, the word. We can't depend upon anything. We just have to go out and do a performance. And the performance is believable. They respond. If it's acrobatic, they respond. If it's sensuous, they respond. And that's all we can depend upon. The name doesn't mean anything. It's all in how believable or how sensitive the oral presentation. And if it's agreeable to the ear, then you are very fortunate, because then you are together, you know. To my people. Oh, my people. Can I tell you about that?
Ellington was adamant in his refusal to be confined to categories, whether regarding his music or his identity. When asked about his relationship to his people, his response could be unpredictable.
Yeah, I'm glad you're recording this. I want to hear that. The music of my people is what? It has to do with the... What? I mean, what is that? Now, that's a strange question. You know, I was afraid you were going to do this, get me out here on this tape and expose me to my own ignorance or something. Let's see. My people. Now, which of my people? I mean, you know, I'm in several groups, you know. I'm in the group of the piano players. I'm in the group of the listeners. I'm in the groups of people who have general appreciation of music. I'm in the group of those who aspire to be dilettantes. I'm in the group of those who attempt to produce something fit for the plateau. I'm in the group of what? Oh, yeah, those who appreciate Beaujolais. Yeah. And then, of course, I'm in the... because I had such a strong influence by the music of the people. The people, that's the better word. The people rather than my people. Because the people are my people.
I think he was a great con. One of the great cons of all time. But that doesn't make one bad to be a confidence person. I think many of our great prophets wanted to get confidence. And you were a man who needed confidence. You needed your confidence. You needed the confidence of each man in his orchestra in order for it to be the kind of unit that it was. Because remember, this was a man who had trained his orchestra to play arrangements without ever looking at the book. And they'd memorize the arrangements. It was perhaps one of the greatest lessons of communication that I ever had in my life while being with the Ellington Aggregation. Religion. but he was godly in his heart. You know, he did write some great things, and of course, he was very heavily involved in the sacred musics, you know, in the latter years of his life.
His music was different both in its time and it's still different today in perspective because it had its own personality stamped on it because it combined all the important elements of jazz, melodic, harmonic, rhythmic, and improvisational. And I think it had the best mix of composition and improvisation that anybody was able to achieve. And that was part of the genius. Plus, he had a marvelous feeling for melody and a wonderful feeling for harmony. It all went together. Many other people have done the same thing, but with less degree of success. And Duke just came up with some magnificent works, orchestral works. And I think the most important thing about his music is not the fact that he wrote a hit songs like Solitudes for Skinny Louie or Satin Doll, which is one of the lesser ones to me, but that he wrote so many great instrumental works for the orchestra. If nobody had ever written a single lyric to anything that Duke Ellington ever wrote, he would still be remembered as a great composer. It doesn't matter if he was a great songwriter, too. That was secondary.
He always was ahead. He always kept, he didn't go backwards. He went forward all the time when writing. His music stayed ahead all the time.
Coming up, I felt pretty solid that I could hear that too.
and I could see Ellington up on the podium and I was white tie and tails. I felt like I could do the same thing, you know. It was a wonderful summer.
It was rested. You felt good. And so did the musicians, even if they remember perhaps having had arguments with him, you know, but in they left him, but they always came back. Because once you work with Duke, you are never the same after that.
When I got on the stage, the concert hall, or wherever it was, when I started blowing the horn and playing music, everything was right with the world. Whether I was hungry, sick, broke, hadn't seen my family in 6 months or whatever. It was all right long as I started playing that music.
Duke Ellington is a master in his own right and certainly deserved as much, if not more, attention than George Gershwin. And I'm afraid that he wasn't given that attention.
I think that in due time, the world's going to find out way down the line. What a great, great musician, this man, really.
And my hat's off to you for the rest of my life and for the rest of the journey.
Show was included in Duke's work. You found ragtime, you found Dixieland, you found swing. And actually, you found some modern music, modern jazz. Because he came around that particular time back in the 50s when modern jazz was occurring, except that they did it in small groups, except for a couple of bands, such as, one person that was Dizzy Gillespie had a big band, and so did Billy Eckstein. Those bands, yes, around in the 50s. So there's so much information about Duke and this genius and his work that there's no way in the world that we can stop. We're only part two. So next week I plan on doing once again one work about Duke Ellington again. We're going to call it part three. And so... this is Dr. Walter Dean, getting it done, and we're going to close out with Duke playing Blues in Orbit. I'm gonna go get some more.